They all spoke of a kind of a medium-sized fella in his 30s, or might be his 40s. No, he wasn't fat, but he wasn't thin either. Blue eyes? Could be brown. The answer to these questions and many more are coming up here on the Mystery Hour, here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Hey folks, how you doing? Keith Tyler here. Thrilled to be bringing you this show and very, very happy that you're with me. The book I'm reading from is The Best American Mystery Stories from the Century. This happens to be the last century, as this story was written in 1950 by John D. McDonald. It's called The Homesick Buick. To get to Lehman, Texas, you go southwest from Beaumont on Route 94, approximately 30 miles, and then turn right on a two-lane concrete farm road. 5 minutes from the time you turn, you will reach Lehman. The main part of town is 6 lanes wide and 5 blocks long. If the hand of a careless giant would remove the 6 gas stations, the 2 theaters, Willow's Hardware Store, the Lehman National Bank, the 2 big air-conditioned Five and Dimes, the Sears Store, 4 cafes, Ringsinger's Dress Shop, and the Lehman House, a 20-room hotel, there would be very little left except the supermarket and 4 drugstores. On October 3rd, 1949, a Mr. Stanley Woods arrived by bus and carried his suitcase over to the Lehman House. In Lehman, there is no social distinction of bus, train, or plane, since Lehman has neither airport facilities nor railroad station. On all those who were questioned later, Mr. Stanley Wood seemed to have made very little impression. They all spoke of kind of a medium-sized fella in his 30s, or it might have been his 40s. No, he wasn't fat, but he wasn't thin either. Blue eyes, could have been brown. Wore a gray suit, I think. Can't remember whether his glasses had rims or not. If they did have, they were probably gold. But all were agreed that Mr. Stanley Woods radiated quiet confidence and the smell of money. According to the cards that were collected here and there, Mr. Woods represented the Groston Precision Tool Company of Atlanta, Georgia. He had deposited in the Lehman National a certified check for $1,200, and the bank had made the routine check of looking up the credit standing of Groston. It was Dun & Bradstreet AA. But of course, the company explained later that they had never heard of Mr. Stanley Woods, nor could the fake calling cards be traced. They were of a type of paper and face type that could be duplicated 60 or 100 times in every big city in the country. Mr. Woods' story, which all agreed on, was that he was nosing around to find a good location for a small plant. Decentralization, you know. No, we don't want it right in town. He rented Todd Bishner's car during the day. Todd works at the Shell station on the corner of Beaumont and Lone Star Street and doesn't have any use for his Plymouth sedan during the day. Mr. Woods drove around all the roads leading out of town, and of course, real estate prices were jacked to a considerable degree during his stay. Mr. Stanley Woods left Lehman rather suddenly on the morning of October 17th under unusual circumstances. The first person to note a certain oddness was Miss Trilla Price on the switchboard at the phone company. Her local calls were all right, but she couldn't place Charlie Anderson's call to Houston, nor, when she tried, could she raise Beaumont. Charlie was upset because he wanted to wrangle an invitation to go visit his sister over the coming weekend. That was at 9:05. It was probably at the same time that a car with 2 men in it parked on Beaumont Street, diagonally across from the bank. and one of the two men lifted the hood and began to fiddle with the electrical system. Nobody agrees from what direction the Buick came into town. There was a man and a girl in it, and they parked near the drugstore. No one seems to know where the third car parked or even what kind of car it was. The girl and the man got out of the Buick slowly, just as Stanley Woods came down the street from the hotel. In Lehman, the bank is open on weekdays from 9 until 2, and so at 9 o'clock, C.F. Hetheridge, who is, well, or was, the chief teller, raised the green shades on the inside of the bank doors and unlocked the doors. He greeted Mr. Woods, who went on over to the high counter at the east wall and began to ponder over his checkbook. At this point, out on the street, a very peculiar thing happened. One of the two men in the first car strolled casually over and stood beside the Buick. The other man started the motor of the first car, drove down the street, and made a wide U-turn to bring it in and park behind the Buick. The girl and the man had gone over to Bob Kimball's window. Bob is second teller, and the only thing he can remember about the girl is that she was blonde and a little hard-looking around the mouth, and that she wore a great big alligator shoulder bag. The man with her made no impression on Bob at all, except that Bob thinks the man was on the heavy side. Old Rod Harrigan, the bank guard, was standing beside the front door, yawning and picking his teeth with a broken match. At this point, C.F. Hetheridge heard the buzzer on the big-time vault and went over and swung the door wide and went in to get the money for the cages. He was out almost immediately, carrying Bob's tray over to him. The girl was saying something about cashing a check, and Bob had asked her for identification. She had opened the big shoulder bag as her escort strolled over to the guard. At the same moment, the girl pulled out a small, vicious-looking revolver and aimed it between Bob's eyes. Her escort sapped old Rod Harrigan with such gusto that it was 4 that same afternoon before he came out of it enough to talk, and then, of course, he knew nothing. C.F. Hetheridge bolted for the vault, and Bob, wondering whether he could step on the alarm, looked over the girl's shoulder just in time to see Stanley Woods aim carefully and bring Hetheridge down with a slug through the head, catching him on the fly, so to speak. Bob says that things were pretty confusing and that the sight of Hetheridge dying so suddenly sort of took the heart out of him. Anyway, there was a third car and it contained 3 men, 2 of them equipped with empty black leather suitcases. They went into the vault, acting as though they had been all through the bank 50 times. They stepped over Hetheridge on the way in and on the way out again. About the only cash they overlooked was the cash right in front of Bob in his teller's drawer. As they all broke for the door, Bob dropped and pressed the alarm button. He said later that he held his hand over his eyes, though what good that would have done him, well, he couldn't say. Henry Willows is the real hero. He was futting around in his hardware store when he heard the alarm. With a reaction time remarkable in a man close to 70, he took a little .22 rifle, slapped a clip into it, trotted to his store door, and quickly analyzed the situation. He saw Mr. Woods, whom he recognized, plus 3 strangers and a blonde woman coming out of the bank pretty fast. The 3 cars were lined up, each one with a driver. 2 of the men coming out of the bank carried heavy suitcases. Henry leveled on the driver of the lead car, the Buick, and shot him in the left temple, killing him outright. The man slumped over the wheel, his body resting against the horn ring, which of course added its blare to the clanging of the bank alarm. At that point, a slug, later identified as having come from a Smith & Wesson police positive, smashed a neat hole in Henry's plate glass store window, radiating cracks in all directions. Henry ducked, and by the time he got ready to take a second shot, 2 other cars were already gone. The Buick Well, it was still there. He saw Bob run out of the bank, and later he told his wife that he had his finger on the trigger and his sights lined up before it came to him that it was Bob Kimball. It was agreed that the two cars headed out toward Route 90, and within 2 minutes, Hod Abrams and Lefty Quinn had roared out of town in the same direction in the only police car. They were followed by belligerent amateurs to whom Henry Willows had doled out firearms, but on the edge of town, all cars ran into an odd obstacle. The road was liberally sprinkled with metal objects shaped exactly like the jacks that little girls pick up when they bounce a ball, except they were 4 times normal size, and all the points were sharpened. No matter how a tire hit one, it was certain to be punctured. The police car swerved to a screaming stop, nearly tipping over. The Stein twins, boys of 19, managed to avoid the jacks in their souped-up heap until they were hitting 80. When they finally hit one, the heap rolled over an estimated 10 times, killing the twins outright. So that made 4 dead, Hetheridge, the Stein twins, and 1 unidentified bank robber. Nobody wanted to touch the robber, and he stayed right where he was until the battery almost ran down and the horn squawked into silence. Hod Abrams commandeered a car, and he and Lefty rode back into town and took charge. They couldn't get word out by phone, and within a very short time they found that some sharpshooter with a high-powered rifle had gone to work on the towers of local station WLEE and had put the station out of business. Thus, by the time the Texas Rangers were alerted and ready to set up roadblocks, indecision and confusion had permitted an entire hour to pass. The Houston office of the FBI assigned a detail of men to the case, and from the Washington headquarters, 2 bank robbery experts were dispatched by plane to Beaumont. Reporters came from Houston and Beaumont, and the 2 national press services and Lehman found itself on the front pages all over the country because the planning behind the job seemed to fascinate the average Joe. Mr. Woods left town on that particular Thursday morning. The FBI from Houston was there by noon, and the Washington contingent arrived late Friday. Everyone was very confident. There were a corpse and a car to work on. These would certainly provide the necessary clues to indicate which outfit had pulled the job, even though the method of the robbery did not point to any particular group whose habits were known. Investigation headquarters were set up in the local police station, and Hod and Lefty, very important in the beginning, had to stand around outside trying to look as though they knew what was going on. Hetheridge, who had been a cold, reserved, unpopular man, had, within 24 hours, 50 stories invented about his human kindness and generosity. The Stein twins, heretofore considered to be trash, who would be better off in prison, suddenly became proper sons of old Texas. Special Agent Randolph A. Steinweister, who 15 years before had found a law office to be a dull place, was in charge of the case, being the senior of the 2 experts who had flown down from Washington. He was 41 years old, a chain smoker, a chubby man with incongruous hollow cheeks and hair of a shade of gray which his wife, Claire, tells him is distinguished. The corpse was the first clue. Age between 30 and 32, brown hair, thinning on top, good teeth with only 4 small cavities, 2 of them filled, height 5 feet 8 1/4, weight 148, no distinguishing scars or tattoos. X-ray plates showed that the right arm had been fractured years before. His clothes were neither old nor new. The suit had been purchased in Chicago. The shirt, underwear, socks, and shoes were all national brands in the medium price range. In his pockets, they found an almost full pack of cigarettes, a battered Zippo lighter, 3 5s and a 1, in a cheap trick bill clip, $0.85 in change, a book of matches advertising a nationally known laxative, a white bone button, two wooden kitchen matches with blue and white heads, and a penciled map on cheap notebook paper of the main drag of Leman, with no indication as to escape route. His fingerprint classification was teletyped to Central Bureau files, and the answer came back that there was no record of him. It was at this point that fellow workers noted that Mr. Steinweister became a shade irritable. The next search of the corpse was more minute. No specific occupational calluses were found on his hands. The absence of laundry marks indicated that his linen, if it had been sent out, had been cleaned by a neighborhood laundress. Since Willows had used a 22 hollow point, the hydraulic pressure on the brain fluids had caused the eyes of Mr. X to bulge in a disconcerting fashion. A local undertaker, experienced in the damage caused by the average Texas automobile accident, replaced the bulging eyeballs and smoothed out the expression for a series of pictures which were sent to many points. The Chicago office reported that the clothing store which had sold the suit was large and that the daily traffic was such that no clerk could identify the customer from the picture, nor was the youngest man known to the Chicago police. Fingernail scrapings were put in a labeled glassine envelope, as well as the dust vacuum from the pants cuffs and other portions of the clothing likely to collect dust. The excellent lab in Houston reported back that the dust and scrapings were negative to the extent that the man could not be tied down to any particular locality. In the meantime, the Buick had been the object of equal scrutiny. The outside was a mass of prints from citizens of Leman who had peered morbidly in at the man leaning against the horn ring. The plates were Mississippi plates, and in checking with the Bureau of Motor Vehicle Registration, it was found that the plates had been issued to a 1949 Mercury convertible, which had been almost totally destroyed in a head-on collision in June of 1949. The motor number and serial number of the Buick were checked against Central Records, and it was discovered that the Buick was one which had disappeared from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, on the 5th of July, 1949. The insurance company, having already replaced the vehicle, was anxious to take possession of the stolen car. Pictures of Mr. X relayed to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and to myriad points in Mississippi, drew a large blank. In the meantime, a careful dusting of the car had brought out six prints, all different. Two of them turned out to be on record. The first was on record through the cross-classification of Army prints. The man in question was found working in a gas station in Lake Charles, Louisiana. He had a very difficult 2 hours until a bright police officer had him demonstrate his procedure for brushing out the front of a car. Ex-Sergeant Golden braced his left hand against the dashboard in almost the precise place where the print had been found. He was given a picture of Mr. X to study. By that time, was so thoroughly annoyed with the forces of law and order that it was impossible to ascertain whether or not he had ever seen the man in question. But due to apparent freshness of the paint, it was established, a reasonable assumption, that the gangsters had driven into Texas from the east. The second print on record was an old print, visible when dust was carefully blown off the braces under the dismantled front seat. It belonged to a garage mechanic in Chapel Hill, who once had a small misunderstanding with the forces of law and order, and who was able to prove, through the garage work orders, that he had repaired the front seat mechanism when it had jammed in April 1949. The samples of road dirt and dust taken from the fender wells and the frame members proved nothing. The dust was proved spectroscopically to be from deep in the heart of Texas, and the valid assumption, after checking old weather reports, was that the car had come through some brisk thunderstorms en route. Butts in the ashtray of the car showed that either two women, or one woman with two brands of lipstick, had ridden recently as a passenger. Both brands of lipstick were of shades which would go with a fair-complexioned blonde, and both brands were available in Woolworths, Cress's, Kreskies, Walgreens, in fact, every chain outfit of any importance. One large crumb of stale whole wheat bread was found on the floor mat, and even Steinweister could make little of that, despite the fact that the lab was able to report that the bread had been eaten in conjunction with liverwurst. Attention was given to the oversized jacks, which had so neatly punctured the tires. An ex-OSS officer reported that similar items had been scattered on enemy roads in Burma during the late war, and after examining the samples, he stated confidently that the OSS merchandise had been better made. A competent machinist looked them over and stated with assurance that they had been made by cutting 8-inch rods into short lengths, grinding them on a wheel, putting them on a jig, and spot welding them. He said that the maker did not do much of a job on either the grinding or the welding, and that the jig itself was a little out of line. An analysis of the steel showed that it was a Jones and Laughlin product that could be bought in quantity at any wholesaler and in a great many hardware stores. The auditors, after careful examination of the situation at the bank, reported that the sum of exactly $94,725 had disappeared. They recommended that the balance of $982.80 remaining in Stanley Wood's account be confiscated as forfeited, thus reducing the loss to $93,742.20. The good citizens of Lehman preferred to think that Stanley had withdrawn his account. Every person who had a glimpse of the gang was cross-examined. Steinweister was appalled at the difficulty involved in even establishing how many there had been. Woods, the blonde, and the stocky citizen were definite. And then there were two with suitcases, generally agreed upon. Total so far, five. The big question was whether each car had a driver waiting. Some said no, that the last car in line had been empty. Willows insisted angrily that there had been a driver behind each wheel. Steinweister at least settled for a total of eight, seven of whom escaped. No one had taken down a single license number, but it was positively established that the other two cars had been either two- or four-door sedans in dark blue, black, green, or maroon, and that they had been either Buicks, Nashes, Oldsmobile, Chryslers, Pontiacs, or Packards, or maybe Hudsons. And one lone woman held out for convertible Cadillacs. For each person that insisted that they had Mississippi registration, there was one equally insistent on Louisiana, Texas, Alabama, New Mexico, and Oklahoma. And one old lady said that she guessed she knew a California plate when she saw one. On Saturday morning, 9 days after the sudden blow to the FDIC, Randolph Steinweister paced back and forth in his suite at the hotel, which he shared with the number two man from the Washington end, one Buckley Weed. Weed was reading through the transcripts of the testimony of the witnesses, in vain hope of finding something to which insufficient importance had been given. Weed, though lean, a bit stooped, and only 31, had, through osmosis, acquired most of the personal mannerisms of his superior. Steinweister had noticed this, and for the past year had been on the verge of mentioning it, as Weed had acquired Steinweister's habit of lighting one cigarette off the last half-inch of the preceding one, any room in which the two of them remained for more than an hour, took on the look and smell of any hotel room after a Legion convention. "Nothing," Steinweister said. "Not one censored, unmentionable, unprintable, unspeakable thing. My God, if I ever want to kill somebody, I'll do it in the Pensy station at 5:15.
"Yes, at 5:15, said Weed.
"The Bureau has cracked cases, which the only thing in it to go on was a human hair or a milligram of dust. My God, we've got a whole automobile that weighs nearly 2 tons, and a whole corpse. They'll think that we're down here learning to rope calves, you know what?"
"What, Ran?"
"I think this was done by a bunch of amateurs. There ought to be a law restricting the practice of crime to professionals. A bunch of wise amateurs. And you can bet your loudest argyles, my boy, that they established identity, hideout, the works before they knocked off that vault. Right now, blast their souls, there being 7 average citizens in some average community making no splash with the 94 grand. People didn't use to move around so much. Since the war, they've been migrating all over the place. See anything in those transcripts?"
"No, nothing."
"Well, then stop rattling paper. I can't think. Since a week ago, Thursday, 51 stolen cars have been recovered in the South and Southwest, and we don't know which 2, if any, belong to this mob. We don't even know which route they took away from here. Believe it or not, nobody saw 'em." As the two specialists stared bleakly at each other, a young man of 14 named Pink D was sidling inconspicuously through the shadows of the rear of Louis' garage, tow car service open 24 hours. Pink was considered to have been the least beautiful baby, the most unprepossessing child in Lehman, and he gave frank promise of growing up to be a rather coarse joke on the entire human race. Born with a milk-blue skin, dead-white hair, little reddish weak eyes, pipe-cleaner bones, narrow forehead, no chin, beaver teeth, and a voice like an unoiled hinge, nature had made the unusual compensation. His reaction time was exceptional. Plenty of more rugged and more normal children had found out that Pink D could hit you by the time you had the word out of your mouth. The blow came from an outsized knobby fist at the end of a long, thin arm, and he swung it with all the abandon of a bag of rocks at the end of a rope. The second important item about Pink D came to light when the Lehman school system started giving IQs. Pink was higher than they were willing to admit the first time, as it did not seem proper that the only genius in Lehman should be old Homer D's only son. Pink caught on, and the second time he was rated, he got it down to the Cretan class. The third rating was 99, and everybody seemed happy with that. At 14, Pink was 6 feet tall and weighed 120 pounds. He peered at the world through heavy lenses and maintained in the back room of his home on Fountain Street myriad items of apparatuses, some made, some purchased. There he investigated certain electrical and magnetic phenomena. Having tired of building radios and carried on a fairly virulent correspondence on the quantum theory with a Caltech professor who was under the impression that he was arguing with someone of more mature years. Dressed in his khakis, Pink moved through the shadows, inserted the key he had filched into the Buick door, and then into the ignition lock. He turned it to the left to activate the electrical gimmicks, and then turned on the car radio. As soon as it warmed up, he punched the selective buttons, carefully noting the dial. When he had the readings, he turned it to WLEE to check the accuracy of the dial. When WLEE roared into a farm report, Louis appeared and dragged Pink out by the thin scruff of his neck.
"What the heck?" Louis said.
Being unable to think of any adequate explanation, Pink wriggled away and loped out. Pink's next stop was WLEE, where he was well known. He found the manual he wanted and spent the next 20 minutes leafing through it. Having been subjected to a certain amount of sarcasm from both Steinweister and Weed, Hod Abrams and Lefty Quinn were in no mood for the approach of Pink D.
"I demand to see the FBI,"
Pink said firmly, the effect spoiled a bit by the fact that his voice change was so recent that the final syllable was a reversion to his childhood squeaky hinge voice.
"He demands," Hod said to Lefty. "Go away, Pink," Lefty growled, "before I stomp on your glasses."
"I am a citizen who wishes to speak with a member of a federal agency," Pink said with dignity.
"A citizen, maybe. Taxpayer, no. You give me trouble, kid, and I'm going to warm your pants right here in this lobby."
Maybe the potential indignity did it. Pink darted for the stairs leading up from the main lobby. Hod went roaring up the stairs after him, and Lefty grabbed the elevator. They both snared him outside Steinweister's suite and found that they had a job on their hands. Pink bucked and contorted like a picnic on which a hornet's nest had just fallen. The door to the suite opened, and both Steinweister and Weed glared out, their mouths open.
"Just a fresh kid," Hod Abrams panted.
"I know where the cooks are," Pink screamed.
"He's nuts," Lefty yelled.
"Wait a minute," Randolph Steinweister ordered sharply. They stopped, dragging Pink, but still clung to him.
"I admit he doesn't look as though he knew his way home, but you can't tell. You two wait outside. Come in here, young man."
Pink marched erectly into the suite, selected the most comfortable chair, and sank into it looking very smug.
"Where are they?"
"Well, I don't know exactly."
"Outside," Weed said with a thumb motion.
"But I know how to find out."
"Oh, you know how to find out, eh? Keep talking. I haven't laughed in 9 days," Steinweister said.
"Oh, I had to do a little checking first," Pink said in a lofty manner. "I stole the key to the Buick and got into it to test something."
"Kid, experts have been over that car half inch by half inch.
Please don't interrupt me, sir. And don't take that attitude, because if it turns out I have something, and I know I have, you're going to look as silly as anything."
Steinweister flushed and then turned pale. He held hard to the edge of the table.
"Go ahead," he said thickly.
"I am making an assumption that the people who robbed our bank started out from some hideout and then went back to the same one. I am further assuming that they were in their hideout sometime, that is, while they were planning the robbery."
Weed and Steinweister glanced at each other.
"Go on."
"So my plan has certain possible flaws based on these assumptions, but at least it uncovers one possible pattern of investigation. I know that the car was stolen from Chapel Hill. That was in the paper. And I know the dead man was in Chicago, so I checked Chicago and Chapel Hill a little while ago."
"Check them?"
"At the radio station, of course. Modern car radios are easy to set to new stations by altering the push buttons. The current setting of the push buttons do not conform either to Chicago or Chapel Hill areas. There are 6 stations that the radio in the Buick is set for, and..."
Steinweister sat down on the couch as though somebody had clubbed him between the knees.
"Ugh," he said.
"So all you have to do," Pink said calmly, "is to check areas against the push-button settings until you find an area where all 6 frequencies are represented by radio stations in the immediate geographical vicinity. It will take a bit of statistical work, of course, and a map of the country and a supply of push-pins should simplify things, I would imagine. Then, after the area is located, I would take the Buick there, and due to variations in individual sets and receiving conditions, you might be able to narrow it down to within, well, a mile or two. Then, by showing the photograph of the dead gangster around the bars and such places. And that was why, on the following Wednesday, a repainted Buick, with new plates and containing two agents of the Bureau, roamed through the small towns near Tampa on the West Florida coast, and how they found that the car radio in the repainted Buick brought in Tampa, Clearwater, St. Pete, Orlando, Winter Haven, and Dunedin on the push buttons with remarkable clarity the closer they came to a little resort town called Tarpon Springs. On Thursday morning at 4, the portable floodlights bathed three beach cottages in a white glare, and the metallic voice of the PA system said, "You are surrounded! Come out with your hands high! You are surrounded!" The shots, a few moments later, cracked with a thin bitterness against the heavier sighing of the Gulf of Mexico. Mr. Stanley Woods, or as the blonde later stated, Mr. Grebs Feinstock, was shot with poetic justice through the head, and that was the end of resistance. On Pink Lee Day in Lehman, the president of the Lehman National Bank turned over the envelope containing the reward. It came to a bit less than 6% of the total recovered funds, and it is ample to guarantee at some later date a Caltech degree. In December, the Steinmeisters bought a new car. When Claire demanded to know why Rudolph insisted on delivery sans car radio, his only answer was a hollow laugh. She feels that he has probably been working too hard. Well, very good then. Okay, I'm going to switch over now to the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. From their Department of the First Stories, this story is penned by Julia McCrie. Forgive me, Julia, if I'm mispronouncing that. And it's called The Death of Agatha. Act 1. And Agatha was dead, to begin with. This was no great surprise at first. Agatha was scripted to die at the end of Act 1. The shock came when Agatha didn't rise again after the curtain fell. Dead in the play, and dead in life. Broadway star Tricia Lawrence, guest starring as Agatha in our high school production, lay completely still on stage. A few of us waiting in the wings circled Miss Lawrence as our music teacher, Mr. Elba, pushed through to see her. We looked on like an audience watching an improvisational play. Mr. Elba kneeled at Ms. Lawrence's side. He fumbled around looking for a pulse. He pulled out his phone and pressed three numbers. His conversation was drowned out by the anxious audience waiting beyond the curtain. Their anxiety was not due to Ms. Lawrence's demise. Most of them would only learn of her death later that evening on Instagram. Their anxiety was due to the promise of two more acts of our high school's production, and then there were three. It was a completely original amalgamation. We combined scenes and themes from Othello, and Then There Were None, and A Christmas Carol. Our school's yearly productions were known for their inventive combinations. My all-time favorite was the mashup of The Sound of Music, The Crucible, titled The Hills That Scream. It was reviewed by our local paper as confusing, yet moving, and everyone agreed Rolf was at home in Salem. Tonight's play was our most ambitious. It was a story about justice and redemption. Agatha was the protagonist, who was a fusion of Scrooge, Othello, and Justice Wargrave. Accused of murdering her lover, Desdemona, Agatha flees to a remote island with her confidant, Iago. At the end of Act One, she appears to commit suicide, but she faked her own death because her suspect... But she faked her own death because she suspects Iago is plotting against her. In Act Two, we learn that Agatha was a bully for most of her life. She is visited by three spirits, reliving her past crimes, and at last redemption comes in Act Three. Iago and Agatha walk hand in hand to the island police station to admit their respective crimes. It was likely a mercy that the play died with Ms. Lawrence. The audience was sent home, and the police arrived with a whirl of energy. They suspected it was murder from the start, and murder is rarely solved in one act. This murder had three. Act Two. Max barged into my room the next morning. He looked like a tramp out of a Charlie Chaplin film. His hair stuck up on end, and it appeared his pajamas had gone to war while he slept. They were tangled and misaligned. True to form, he skipped any conversational warm-up such as, "How did you sleep?" and dove right in with, "So, Rose darling, who do we think did it?" Max was my best friend and temporary roommate, his sole guardian. His stepmother was deciding whether she could stomach him under her roof again. Max had recently come out to her, using Iago's line, "I am not what I am." Thematically, the quote was perfect because he had been dating a girl at the time. Unfortunately for Max, his stepmother was just as suspicious of Elizabethan playwrights as she was of alternative lifestyles. Max's mother died in a car accident when he was 10. She was hit by the town drunk, Mr. Cole. The sole survivor of the accident was a young Tricia Lawrence. No one knew why she was in the car with Mr. Cole, but everyone assumed a May-December affair. She left for Broadway a few months after the accident. In a category of things that could only happen in a small town, Max's dad married Mr. Cole's widow. With that, our version of the Brady Bunch was formed, although it was much shorter run. His dad died soon after, apparent suicide, and Mrs. Cole was all he had left. Max began hypothesizing suspects. "It's always the butler in your Agatha Christie novels, right? So it must have been Fred." Fred was our classmate who had at least 12 small roles in our play, one of which was the butler. I corrected Max. It is not her style at all to have a butler do it. And as to Fred, as far as I know, he had zero interaction with Ms. Lawrence. He's the least likely suspect. Max argued, "Well then, Rose, if this was in fact an Agatha Christie novel, it would be a strong indicator that Fred was the killer, being least likely and all." "And if not Fred?" I countered. Max grabbed my laptop and typed in my password. Max was truly Napoleonic in that he never met a boundary he wouldn't cross. He pulled up the Word document and titled it The Suspects. "Okay, we can apparently rule Fred out, and obviously it wasn't you or me," Max said. "The first thing we need to do is write down our account of yesterday." And by our, he really meant our. Max and I split the part of Iago. Our school did this whenever two students wanted the same part. It was more equitable. In preparation, we stuck together like glue. Max argued we needed to ensure our Iago was as integrated as possible. We therefore had the advantage of two sets of eyes on the same sequence of events. The only time we were apart was when we were on stage as Iago. Ms. Lawrence arrived at 4 p.m., exactly 1 hour late for her call. Max and I had seen it all sitting next to our lockers, eating blue freezes, dressed in our Dickensian best. She had her jewel in one hand and her cell phone in the other. She looked like an Arabian horse at a local county fair. She left a cloud of cool cucumber vapor in her wake. Max typed, "So Ms. Lawrence arrived late and then was confronted with varying degrees of anger from her three closest friends." Mr. Elba had spotted her first. He bowed curtly as if passive-aggressively thanking her for showing up at all. There was a time when Ms. Lawrence not showing up cost Mr. Elba his chance to make it on Broadway. Everyone in town knew this story. Ms. Lawrence and Mr. Elba were in high school together. She had gone to New York after the car accident, stood in line for an open call audition, and had been selected out of thousands of people for a supporting role. After that run, she got a headlining role in an off-Broadway show that, with a little bit of luck, would surely go to Broadway. Ms. Lawrence got her friend, Mr. Elba, a role too. He moved to New York for his big break, and then, on the first day of rehearsals, she just hadn't shown up. She was offered a better role somewhere else. The off-Broadway show stayed off-Broadway, and Mr. Elba came back home. Shane was next to encounter Ms. Lawrence. He was Shane to us, and not Mr. McCowell, because we both worked part-time at his eco-friendly and all-natural flower nursery. The only reaction we noted was a quick look at his watch to mark her late arrival. Shane was our prop master for the show, but only because Ms. Lawrence volunteered his time. They were an off-and-on couple. They had dated in high school until the car accident. She had then picked him up again when she came back to town. We all knew she would drop him just as fast when she left. He seemed to love and fear her in equal measure. And lastly, Ms. Deborah, our larger-than-life musical director. Her reaction to Ms. Lawrence was most dramatic. She locked eyes with her, walked abruptly down the hall to the staff room, and slammed the door for effect. Ms. Deborah had been a big-time musical director for 15 years until she decided she wanted a break and of all places came to our little school. She knew Ms. Lawrence from their time together in New York. As for their relationship now, well, we knew she was working with her on selling a new musical. Although it appeared Ms. Deborah's attitude toward Ms. Lawrence had soured over the last few weeks. I sat up in bed, trying to imagine little gray cells moving around in my brain, using this information to deduce important facts. After 30 seconds of concerted effort, I shrugged. "I don't think we have enough information." They were all annoyed with her, but surely annoyance doesn't end in murder. Yes, they were annoyed that she was arriving late, but there is more to it. When did we see Ms. Lawrence next? I don't remember. Max smiled, the smile of patience. Okay, so then she went to the girls' bathroom for hair and makeup. And then we both independently saw her on stage as we did our scene with her. Nothing unusual, right? And then Max flashed his own prompt. She was at the props table with Shane, remember? Oh, I do remember this. I was on stage delivering my sport and profit soliloquy. I looked over at you mouthing my lines off stage. Shane was misting Ms. Lawrence with a spray bottle so that she looked like she had just swum in the sea. I closed my eyes, picturing Ms. Lawrence at the props table. She held the moistened palm leaves that took you so long to make. I continued. Oh, and as usual, she was smoking her jewel backstage, even though Mr. Elba repeatedly told her to stop. But it wasn't cool cucumber this time. It smelled like vinegar and creme brulee. I could smell it on stage. Mr. Elba came and grabbed the jewel out of her hand and walked off in a huff. Max jumped in. Yes, and Shane whispered the nicotine would just make her more nauseous. And Miss Lawrence said something like nicotine was the only cure for her headache. Then she was on stage for her fake suicide. She did that weird twitching thing she always did before she died, and then she was on the ground. So, who are our suspects? And does any of this help? We don't even know how she died. Max looked as imperious as one can while wearing a bright green tank top. Rose, dear, let's leave the how to the coroner. We are artists and storytellers. Who better to figure out motive? Our suspects are clearly Mr. Elba, Shane, and Miss Deborah. All had motive, hence they are the only ones that matter. Max summarized. Mr. Elba lost out on a stage career because of her. Shane was dating her. If a lion and a mouse can, well, really date. She was emotionally abusive, as we have all a breaking point. And Miss Deborah? Well, she seems to have hated her the most. I heard Miss Deborah was trying to shop a new musical, and Miss Lawrence killed the deal. With that proclamation, Max got up. I'm getting dressed. Please do the same. We are leaving for Mr. Elba's house in 5. Act 3. At Mr. Elba's, 3 doors down from mine, all of Max's suspects sat drinking tea. Each held a letter. Mr. Elba showed us in and handed Max a letter too. The police had found these letters in Ms. Lawrence's hotel room, addressed to them all. Apparently she had been drafting apologies for closing night, her own version of a Christmas morning redemption. These were copies. The originals were being analyzed by the police. Ms. Deborah and Shane were sitting on Mr. Elba's sectional, engrossed in their letters. We followed Mr. Elba to the kitchen for some iced tea. He shared in a hushed tone, the police said it was nicotine poisoning. "Does this mean it was an accident?" I asked. "No," he explained. "The amount of pure nicotine in her system makes it suspicious. She had burns on her hands. They think it was absorbed through her palms." I thought of Shane's eco-friendly nursery that used pure nicotine as an insecticide and gave Max a pointed look. We followed Mr. Elba back into the living room with our iced tea. He picked up his letter to read and reread with the others. No one spoke. I turned to Max. He had not opened his. After failing to get any of our suspects to look up from their letters, we left. Walking back to my house, I pressed Max to read Ms. Lawrence's letter. "Why didn't you get an apology? Aren't you curious?" Max stopped. "Oh, I know exactly why." This was a maddening response. I turned to my front drive, about to press him more, but Max kept walking onward. I called out to him. He didn't look back. He held up the letter and called out, "Justice and redemption." He paused briefly without turning back. He said, "She was driving. Ms. Lawrence was the driver who killed my mom.
And he kept walking in the direction of the police station.
Well, all right, good and lovely people, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Keith Tyler saying thank you again very much for tuning in. Join me again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.